This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Major flooding across much of New England after a summer's worth of rain in just a few hours. It's especially bad in Vermont. Governor Phil Scott.
At this phase, our primary focus continues to be on life and safety before we can shift into a recovery phase.
CBS's Meg Oliver reports a dam near the state capital of Montpelier is causing concern.
The dam nearby here is at maximum capacity tonight. If it overflows, that water would spill into downtown, making this situation worse. Swiftwater rescuers are on standby tonight.
President Biden has approved an emergency declaration and authorized the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA to coordinate disaster relief efforts. Heat alerts stretch from California to Florida, and caring for animals, especially those injured, can be tough. Jules Marin is the operations manager at Austin, Texas Wildlife Rescue.
What we do is challenging on any day, and then add in 100 degrees and hotter, and it just multiplies by 10.
There is a slow-motion disaster going on in Southern California where several homes in a Los Angeles County gated community are slowly sliding downhill. CBS's Elise Preston spoke with a worried homeowner.
To see this continual demise of your house, what is that like to watch?
You know, it's like someone, reach in and pull your guts, but it put in like 1 inch at a time.
Geologists suggest it may have been a deep-seated landslide and Southern California's unique topography. Steep hillsides and weak bedrock coupled with heavy winter rain makes it especially vulnerable.
A Michigan jury rules that a document handwritten by singer Aretha Franklin and found in her couch after her 2018 death is a valid Michigan will. CBS's Matt Piper reports.
The jury's decision is a victory for Aretha Franklin's youngest son, Kelf.
We just want to exhale right now. It's been a long 5 years for my family, my children.
He and one of his brothers believed the singer's final wishes in the 2014 will should be honored instead of one from 2010. The decision means Kelf Franklin will be executed of her estate while also giving him her Bloomfield Hills home. He says the legal dispute will not affect his relationship with another brother who thought the 2010 will was valid. Matt Piper, CBS News.
Thousands of protesters took to the streets in Israel, blocking highways and jamming into the main international airport, demonstrating against the government's plan to overhaul the judicial system. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's parliamentary coalition approved a bill to limit the Supreme Court's oversight powers. This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed, the end-to-end hiring solution. Attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Kuska. Here's what you need to know in northwestern Wisconsin. Tomorrow is the start of the Northern Wisconsin State Fair. The event is in its 125th year. Last year, over 100,000 people attended the event, a record. A new agricultural building addition was made, $6 million the price tag for five new buildings that were built to replace old structures that didn't have modern amenities or enough space for the animal exhibits. Tickets are on sale now for the fair, which runs through Sunday. For the second time this year, the Eau Claire City Council is considering a wheel tax. Earlier this year, a proposed wheel tax of $30 failed to advance to the full council. The new proposal being voted on tonight calls for a $24 vehicle registration fee that would provide an estimated $1.2 million to the city, or about a quarter of the city's budget, for road repairs. A man wanted on murder charges in Eau Claire County is in custody after a months-long manhunt. Kamone Golden was taken into custody by federal marshals in Illinois and will be brought back to Wisconsin on a warrant issued last November. Golden is charged with homicide in a September 22 shooting in Eau Claire. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
When you take the iconic Wienermobile and you call it the Frankmobile, come on, that is terrible.
The Kraft Heinz Company announced the name change to celebrate the brand's 100% beef Franks as the company debuts a new recipe. Oh, no more lips and other things, I guess.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Devil's Advocates Radio.
The entire light beer industry is under attack from the right at this time. Apparently, that they no longer have women in bikinis selling the beer.
I would suggest, and this is on the Fox Entertainment Network.
I believe it's the Fox News. Well,
well, I just hope they don't get to the Captain Morgan and Diet Cokes, man. That'd be a sad day.
The Devil's Advocates Radio with Dom and Crute. Weekdays 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
A guy named Bill out in Econowalk. Bill's got some thoughts on that.
Yeah, thanks for talking about what you're talking about right now. Your station, you raise the bar high for integrity. You are a community radio station, which means you look out for all the citizens in the state of Wisconsin.
Daily conversations about Wisconsin's latest headlines and stories. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Wisconsin's home for daily conversations about the state's latest headlines and stories. Weekday mornings from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Almost 50% by 2035.
And will that be in time?
No, but it's a very good start.
I didn't think so. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today because we didn't have the heart, check out our website at greennews.brandblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Lots of interesting news around the Trump trial. I've seen lots of tweets. I've seen lots of information. I've said from the beginning, and I'll stake my ground right here. I think Trump will be found guilty eventually. He's not going to jail. So the whole fantasy of he's going to be orange suited up and, you know, behind bars with a tin cup singing, oh, woe is me. I don't think that's ever going to happen. I also don't think there's going to be a trial before the election. Please just stop with all the we got him. I'm not buying. I'm not falling for the Mueller thing again. I'm not doing it. But here to share some thoughts on maybe what we can expect, some realistic ideas of what we can expect out of this trial. I've asked our good friend Renato Mariani to come talk with us. He's a former federal prosecutor, so he should know. I don't know, he's kind of done this stuff before. He should know better than the bubblegum lawyer on Twitter. He's also the host of the It's Complicated podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find It's Complicated. Renato, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here, Rick.
So let's start right with this. Any chance that the trial is done before the election so that, you know, he's guilty before the election? Any chance of this?
No, because we just found out recently that Trump's team does not want that to happen. The only way this was going to go to trial before the election is if Trump's team wanted to have the trial before the election. And I'll just tell you that and I know I'm going to get a lot of angry responses on this. Just to be crystal clear, that's not because it's Donald Trump. Rick, if you were indicted for some complex case with 400,000 documents in discovery involving classified documents and you wanted to not have a trial before 2025, I'll tell you right now, we wouldn't have a trial before 2025. Like that's not hard. It's not hard to delay in the federal criminal justice system when you have a very complex case. It's just the reality of how our system works.
No, look, I've known people who have had state charges. It's been 3-4 years before they eventually went to trial. They just kept stalling and delaying. There are thousands of ways where a qualified lawyer, someone who knows how the system works, to slow the wheels down a little bit. Not that the wheels move all that fast in our justice system, but, you know, if you really wanted to throw a wrench into the system, yeah, there's a bunch of ways. No, I mean, you're the lawyer. There's a bunch.
100 different ways. And generally speaking, I mean, what's unusual about what Trump's team is doing is they're putting their cards on the table early. So typically, it's just sort of death by a thousand cuts, so to speak. You know, I have a case, for example, a big fraud case that was indicted in 2020. It's now mid 2023. It's likely going to get continued into 2024. That's just the reality of our judicial system, where there's a lot of people are backed up. You've got lawyers who have busy schedules and other trials. When there's voluminous discovery that gets produced over time by the government, everyone's got to review that. And defense attorneys, if they want to file motions, for example, they can delay things in that regard. Sometimes, for example, defendants fire their attorneys. I've had, when I was a federal prosecutor, I had one defendant fire four different attorneys in the same case to drag the case on for many years because he had figured out a way to escape from prison. True story. He did not want to change. He did not want to change facilities, so he kept firing his attorneys. He eventually escaped from prison like a week after I convicted him at trial, because he had figured out how to keep him. You know, the way to keep yourself in the prison that was right next to the courthouse was to keep firing your attorneys and delaying your trial date. So it's really not hard to do. And, you know, as a practical matter, to me, this is not even really news. The only thing that's interesting about it is certain arguments they're making or the way they're doing it, which is kind of ham-handed.
So why is this going to get you any angry comments? I mean, everybody knows this, especially if you have money. I mean, this is, you know, we know there are two justice systems, one for the very wealthy and one for everybody else, especially the poor. So why would this revelation that I think everybody should have known already, why would this get you any angry comments?
I don't know. I've been fielding angry comments for the last like 48 hours or so, Rick. Lots of people, very vitriolic anger towards me. I think it's because people don't want, when I tell them something they don't want to hear, they get upset at me. And I try to make sure people understand I didn't create the criminal justice system in the United States. I don't have the power to change it. It would be like really neat if I did, if I could create a system from scratch based on what I thought the justice would be. It would be a very different system. We'd spend a lot more time focusing on white collar crime instead of focusing on nonviolent, drug offenses, things like that. So I would have a very different criminal justice system, but the fact of the matter is this is the system we have. I'm describing it the way it is, and it is what it is. I said, Rick, right after Trump was charged, I wrote a column in Politico where I'm a columnist, and I said, he's not going to get tried before the election. And this was before any recent developments. It's common sense. Like, if you actually have practiced federal criminal law, you know that that's going to happen.
No, I'm just a dumb truck driver. And I said the only way he gets this trial before the election is if he believes he can win. Otherwise, right, he's going to play the victim card as long as he can. He's going to play that out to the faithful base as long as he can. And if by some miracle he wins, can he then pardon himself? Because I said he'll just pardon himself. Can he, let's say he is, or does it just end? Does he put someone in the Department of Justice who said, no, we're not going to pursue this anymore?
Yeah, I mean, he could try to pardon himself. It's never happened where a president's pardoned himself. So who knows what would come of that, what the courts would think of that. You know, he could try to just shut down the Justice Department or put some stooge. Jeffrey Clark as Attorney General, right? Yeah. Who the heck knows? I mean, he certainly would have the power to do that. It would be very corrupt, and it would be arguably whatever, some offense, but who's going to prosecute him for it? Who knows what's going to happen? Obviously, frankly, our system of our constitutional system is over in that circumstance. But the reality is that is the stakes for the upcoming election. And that's why I'll just say, I mean, one message that I've probably said, Rick, because this is not my first rodeo when it comes to legal analysis. Okay, I've been doing... Ever since Trump got elected, I've been speaking out about abuses of power. I've been speaking out about, you know, the potential for the rule of law being, you know, ended in our country. And one thing I've always said to people is, please do not put your faith in a bunch of prosecutors in Washington or elsewhere to save America. Okay, you have to get off your asses and mobilize and save America yourselves. I mean, that's the reality of it. I felt the same way when Robert Mueller was supposedly going to indict him for some grand conspiracy with Putin. I thought that was absurd. And now this idea that, look, I thought he was going to be indicted for these documents because it was so obvious, but I don't care who you are. You didn't need to be Donald Trump. You could have been a 77-year-old truck driver. The bottom line is, if you're 77 years old or however old he is, 76 years old, you're going to delay. Like, why would you want to rush to a trial? So he's going to delay. And of course, you can do that in our system. It's just the reality of
that's the other part of it. No, I mean, he's a rich guy with money. He's an older guy. You know, you could probably take this as long as he wants until he finally expires. But the other part of this, and you're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Renato Mariotti, former federal prosecutor and host of the It's Complicated podcast, wherever you find your podcasts. It's Complicated will be there. Hosted by our friend here, Renato. But, you know, there's a lot of thoughts that going around that this judge and this Aileen Cannon, who appointed by Trump, is going to pull some shenanigans. Do you have any concern about that?
Oh, for sure. I do. I mean, just to be clear, this is something I talked about a lot, and it's complicated. I think we did like an episode several weeks ago about this, all the different ways you could tank the trial for Trump. Just to be clear, this is like not even the high on the list. I mean, she could literally, once the jury's impaneled, essentially grant a motion that would essentially end the case that's not reviewable by a court of appeals. So there's all sorts of ways she could tank the case. I will just say that this current motion in front of her, I think most judges, I don't know if they'd grant the motion. I mean, what most judges would do is they'd say, okay, I'll set a trial date for now, like let's say next summer, but I'll entertain any motions in the future to reconsider that and to move it, because we don't even know what the discovery is going to look like. The government has produced over 400,000 documents. They said they have more productions to come. You know, as things develop, as motions get filed, we'll move the trial date. That's probably what most judges would say. Or they'd say, we don't need to worry about this for now. Like, I'll push up, I'm going to take this under advisement and just deal with it later once they have more of a sense of things. But very, very few judges are going to be on board with Jack Smith trying to bulldoze the defendant into having a trial in like under a year over the objections of his attorneys, who are saying they don't have time to prepare and they have too many other cases in their docket and they can't review the documents and they can't file the motions. Like, he's not going to want no try. No judge is going to want to try that case over and over again after appeals. So they're not going to do that.
Did you say 400,000 documents?
Yeah. And this is a classified documents case. So there's all sorts of extra BS that goes into discovery. And by the way, Trump's team hasn't asked for their own discovery yet. I mean, they're probably going to, I mean, if they're smart to slow things down, what they're going to do is they're going to make their own discovery request. They're going to ask for all sorts of other classified documents that the government doesn't want to give up and say that those are necessary for their defense. And those decisions are all going to be litigated out. It's going to take time. And by the way, under SIPA, which is the law that governs this classified document stuff, you can get an immediate appeal. So usually appeals are at the end of the case. You can have what's called an interlocutory appeal. You can go up immediately for appeal. So how many of those do you think there's going to be? I mean, as I said, you don't even need to be imaginative to figure out how this team is going to find ways to delay this. This case won't go to trial for a long time.
So let me ask you, the question on everyone's mind, does it ever happen? Does Trump ever step foot in a courtroom? Is he ever held accountable? Because, look, I mean, Exhibit A is him admitting that he had the classified documents. Him saying, yeah, I had the boxes. It was in the boxes. My stuff was in the boxes. You didn't think I was going to give you my stuff. My stuff was in those boxes. My stuff's more important than your stuff, you and your classified documents, that I'm allowed to have anyway. He admitted it. It's right there. It's cut and dry. Does he ever go to trial?
It's a great question. I think it depends on whether Aileen Cannon forces his hand on that. In other words, I mean, because he's old enough where he could try to run out the clock. Not run out the clock, but just, keep going until he, passes away. I think it would, I mean, in a typical courtroom, and I practice currently as a defense attorney now all over the country, I would say in a typical courtroom, I would see 3 or 4 years of delay in a case like this. Okay. 2 to 4, let's just say. And it depends on how fast the judge is. At a certain point, judge will just say, I've had a judge tell me earlier this year in a case, okay, Mr. Mariotti, we're going to trial. I understand that you the speedy trial rights on your side, but we need to move this case. And we're going to go to trial this year. That's it. Ultimately, the Court of Appeals do not reverse trial judges on these sort of scheduling issues. And so he can, at a certain point, once he feels like I've had my chance to make my motions, to get my discovery, they could do that. But in a case like this, with so much discovery and so many issues and so complicated, and then you have the election. Are they really going to say we're going to have the trial in the middle of the Republican convention or in the middle of, 2 months before the election? Like, there's so many months and that are not even going to work next year, right? I mean, are you going to really do this in November? Like, I mean, I just don't see that. I just don't see it.
No, it's never going to go to trial before the election because, as you pointed out, and so eloquently so, there are so many ways. 400,000 documents that they've already said there's probably more. Wow. Now my mind is maybe this never happens. I said he'll eventually be found guilty, but he's never going to jail. Now I'm reevaluating this all because you. Now I'm going to be angry. I got to reevaluate.
You can be angry at me. You can be angry at me like everyone else, Rick. But by the way, he does have other indictments. I mean, he's got the indictment in Manhattan, which is not a very strong case in comparison. Right. Okay, it's a much weaker case. That's the case you'd probably want to do first if you're in the Trump team because it's the weaker one. You know, that one's set for trial next year. That might get delayed. Who knows? I mean, a lot less complicated of a case. You got the Fulton County. He's probably going to get indicted there. He might get indicted the January 6th thing. But, you know, the fact that he's indicted in multiple jurisdictions also gives him more reason to say he's overwhelmed, right? His team's overwhelmed and he's got all these different trials to schedule and juggle. I mean, he's in a very, very bad position, but – you know, it's not like he's 23, okay? Right. He's, what is he, 76 or something?
He doesn't have a lot of time left. But you know, here's the thing. Out of all of this stuff, and this is kind of where I want to wrap this up. I mean, there's a lot. It's almost like he could have shot somebody on Fifth Avenue and gotten away with it because is he ever going to be held accountable for any of this stuff? I mean, because it seems like it's so much that it's almost like, well, yeah, okay.
You know, it's an interesting thing, Rick. I'll just say this from the experience of somebody who goes through this on a regular basis. For some of my clients, just getting indicted is just, it destroys their life, right? Their businesses go kaput. I've had multiple clients consider committing suicide. I've had their marriages get destroyed. I mean, so much happens to people when they get indicted.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that this guy is going to be indicted multiple times. I've already been indicted twice. That is a lot of more accountability than a lot of people see in this country. There's lots of white collar criminals out there who never get prosecuted because their case is too hard to prove. But yeah, I think, you know, will he get a conviction? Yes. The question is just when. If he becomes reelected as president, he may not get a federal conviction. And we are going to have way bigger problems on our hands than arguing about this criminal case if Donald Trump becomes the president again. So everyone listening to this might want to get off your butts and do something about that and do everything you can to make sure that we get Joe Biden reelected.
There you go. If you're that angry at Renato for coming out with the truth, maybe point that anger, that energy, that all that vitriol in a direction to ensure that he never becomes president again and is able to pardon himself. That seems logical to me. But Renato, as always, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. I look forward to seeing you in Chicago over the next couple of days at Netroots Nation.
All right. I'll be there. See you there.
Good stuff. Our good friend Renato Mariotti. I'm sure if you want to send him angry stuff, you can find him on Twitter at Renato Mariotti. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the dumbest guy in the Senate started the day off kind of stupid. Evidently, according to ABC News, he didn't just double down on the belief that, you know, white nationalists shouldn't be called racist. He tripled down and took a lot of heat for it. Even Mitch McConnell jumped in and said, you know, white supremacy is simply unacceptable in the military and in our whole country. Because even Mitch gets it, knows that this isn't the hill you want to die on. Mitch understands you can be racist and homophobic and all of that stuff. Just admit, it's bad. You can be it, just it's bad. Tommy Tuberville just didn't want to do it. And then I guess eventually relented, eventually caved, and acknowledged to reporters on Capitol Hill, according to the Washington Post, that white nationalists are indeed racist. That was his view. Still hasn't done anything to undo the damage he's doing to our military by holding up, 250 promotions. We don't have a commandant of the Marine Corps right now. First time in 176 years. Thanks, dumb guy in the Senate. And speaking of dumb, Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, he's chosen Marjorie Trainwreck Greene as his pet project. You know, she got booted out of the Freedom Caucus, right? They were trying to contact her. She didn't answer the phone. But McCarthy said, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene is one of the best members we have. Really? You go in there? One of the best members he has. He says, I think she's one of the most conservative members and one of the strongest legislators. I support Marjorie Greene very strongly. He also went on to say, I don't know why they would do something like that from any perspective. I think it's a loss for the Freedom Caucus. Now, the most important person in the House, according to McCarthy there, wants to pull us out of NATO. Yeah, that's her. It's her thought. They're claiming they're not reliable. No, they're not reliable. Now, you think she's bad. Jim Jordan. Evidently, Jim Jordan wants to. Remember, he's the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. He wants to move the FBI headquarters from Washington, D.C. And I got to think that I got a couple things. There's a couple of thoughts here. One, played the dartboard game. Just took a dart and said, you know what? There's the U.S. map. We're going to send the FBI to Huntsville, Alabama. Because that's where he wants to send it. And then my mind went, I've been to Huntsville. It's a lovely place. But not, somewhere that you'd want, if you're, someone who's used to Washington, D.C., probably not somewhere you'd want to go. So it's kind of, I think, a good way to, to clean out the FBI and get a bunch of crazy people like Jim Jordan. That's all I can come up with. That's the crux of it. And understand, you got the Jordans of the world, the Marjorie Greens of the world. You got these folks who, they want to tear down institutions. They want to tear down this country. And because they want to remake it in this place where money, power, control. They want draconian, Christian Sharia law where, heaven forbid you're different. They're coming for you. It's an interesting direction that we're going in this country because of these people. And the reason that these folks are in the positions that they're in is, you've got, massively gerrymandered districts where people like Green and people like Jordan are never going to lose. So they can be as crazy as they want to be. They can be as far out on the fringe as they want to be. They can propose the wildest most insane stuff. Let's put the FBI in Huntsville, Alabama. I think I'm going with the DART, though. I think I don't think he's smart enough to think of, you know, if we move to Alabama, nobody will go. I don't think that's it. I think it's a DART. I think it was the DART. And this is the thing that bothers me with where we are. You've got people who are not serious legislators. What are they doing? Honestly, you know, ask yourself this question. With all of the chaos coming out of Green and Jordan, McCarthy, what have they proposed recently? What have they put forth that's going to make your life better? What have they put forth that's going to help put food on the table, keep a roof over your kid's head, make the job that you have better? What have they done? What has Donald Trump done to earn the loyalty, that the cult-like status that people have of him? That it doesn't, I've had people tell me it doesn't matter what he's done. I don't care. He literally could have shot somebody on Fifth Avenue and they'd be okay with it. What have these people done other than, push the hatred, push the division, make it okay to be deplorable? And not just make it okay, but make it a badge of honor. I've got people in my neighborhood with F. Biden flags flying from their flagpole. They don't have the American flag there. They got the F. Biden flag. What's wrong with these people?
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the day that the American Indian Movement began at a meeting in Minneapolis, Minnesota. A group of 200 Native Americans gathered together to discuss a response to the U.S. government's history of broken treaties and the devastating consequences on Native peoples. The statistics of unyielding poverty and high unemployment in Native communities were staggering. By 1970, 40% of the Native population lived in poverty. The unemployment rate was 10 times the national average. Life expectancy was only 44 years old. In the early 1970s, activists staged a series of occupations at Alcatraz, Wounded Knee, and at Mount Rushmore. Mount Rushmore is built on a site in the Black Hills that is sacred to the Ocheti-Sakowan, or the Great Sioux Nation. The United States government promised Native rights to the land in a treaty that was broken when gold was discovered. In 1972, activists staged a Trail of Broken Treaties caravan, which ended in a six-day occupation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs offices in Washington, D.C. They issued a statement that read, quote, "We seek a new American majority, a majority that is not content merely to confirm itself by superiority of numbers, but which conscience is committed toward prevailing upon the public will in ceasing wrongs and doing right." Beginning in the 1970s, the United States government began to respond to Native people's demands. A series of federal acts gave Native communities more control over their education and improving their health care. Lawsuits brought by tribes resulted in further economic autonomy. Yet by 2014, one in four Native people still lived in poverty.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
About 150 years ago, General Philip Sheridan was sweltering in the relentless heat of a Texas summer. He was not happy. "If I owned Texas and all hell," he groused, "I would rent out Texas and live in hell." Summer has always been hot here, but 2023 has been something else, thanks to a hellish heat dome that has been baking us since late spring, sending daily temps up to 116 degrees. But worse, a more punishing heat has hit us from an even stranger, unnatural dome, the Texas State Capitol. That's where our malicious governor, Greg Abbott, and his GOP majority of extremist right-wing lawmakers rigged the rules to make life easier and richer for corporate elites and much harder for working people. In this year's legislative session, they rammed a nasty piece of plutocratic meanness into law that critics dubbed Death Star. It annihilates the basic right of local officials and voters to govern their own cities and counties. In particular, it empowers autocratic state officials and even corporate executives to nullify decisions by localities to protect workers and others from corporate abuse. In a cruel case of bad timing, the first local law targeted for nullification by the Texas GOP is a humane requirement in Dallas and other cities that developers provide 10-minute water breaks for construction workers. This in a state with America's highest rate of heat-related deaths and presently suffering biblical-level heat. Triple-digit temperatures kill, yet Abbott, his air-conditioned legislative cronies, and his corporate campaign donors whined that a required water break was, quote, an oppressive burden on the extraordinarily rich construction industry. This is Jim Hightower saying, here's a new rule I'd like to see. No lawmaker or lobbyist is allowed to oppose heat protections for workers unless they spend July and August with no air conditioning for themselves.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So this should be an interesting conversation because evidently the Centrist Democrats of America, CDA, they have released a new survey here in my state of Pennsylvania that basically they're saying the majority of Pennsylvanians don't support increased funding for electric vehicles, that they believe that they should be going towards other priorities. I'm not quite sure. So I thought it would be interesting to reach out to the founder and president of Lincoln Park Strategies, the folks behind this polling, and get some thoughts on it. That's why I've asked Stefan Hankin to come talk with us. He's the founder and president of Lincoln Park Strategies. Stefan, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So walk me through this. What's this poll? What's the argument?
Yeah, so the broader argument is that, and I'm going to put this into highlights, right? So voters in Pennsylvania and a bunch of other states where we did research, you know, very concerned about the environment. They're very concerned about gas prices and fuel prices. There is broad support for electric vehicles in the sort of the conceptual stage. But what voters are not getting behind is mandates that just outlaw the sales of or getting rid of gas cars, that you're just saying, like, in Pennsylvania, you cannot sell gas cars after, you know, pick the date. And then, you know, and one of the bigger issues that a lot of voters have is that a lot of these laws are just being indexed to California law and sort of saying, well, whatever California does, we'll do. And, you know, really voters in every state where we did this research, and especially in Pennsylvania, are saying, like, look, Pennsylvania should write its own laws. Even if we support sort of the broader concept of moving towards EVs, let's go more in the approach of let's let the market go in the direction it's going versus putting a heavy hand on the scale.
And are they doing that in Pennsylvania? Did I miss the legislation that was going to end gas vehicles in my state? Did I miss that?
Let me just double check. Like I said, we did this in a bunch of states. So the, you know, what I believe is happening in Pennsylvania and how far down the legislative path it's gone. I am not an expert in that area, but what they're saying is let's try to peg our rules to what California is doing. California, I believe, has passed the law saying that after 2032,
35, I think,
no more gas vehicles being sold.
Right, in California, because they've got some serious air problems. And also, the industries, you know, are kind of moving in that direction, because that seems to be kind of the future. And I've got some problems with the way to get to the place, but I'm not against the idea of electric vehicles. I'm not against the idea of building some infrastructure. I think it could be very helpful for the working class to create the jobs of building that kind of infrastructure and give consumers choice. I mean, we talk about, you know, capitalism. You know, this is an opportunity to create that choice to give consumers the ability. No, I mean, because right now EVs are at a disadvantage because there really isn't an infrastructure to help them.
Exactly. And actually, what you've just said is where the plurality of Pennsylvania residents are, right? So 44% of voters in Pennsylvania say that, you know, the movement towards electric vehicles, it's already happening. You know, it might be a little slower than some of us kind of want, but, like, let's just let the market do its thing. Most car companies have already said that they're, you know, by the mid 2030s, they're going to only be selling electric vehicles. So, like, there's no point to put the heavy hand on the scale. And, you know, from a political standpoint, you know, I look at it and I say, it's like, look, we're already getting to the results that we want, right? And we being people who believe in electric vehicles, want to do everything we can to help the environment, try to reverse global climate change, et cetera. You know, so, but like, if we just turn this into a complete political issue, then we're likely to make things worse. So instead of going for the home run, let's hit four singles and get that run across the plate.
I don't disagree with you, but I'm my mindset has always been government procurement and government policy has pushed forward a lot of the things that we do, the automobile being one of them. We built a massive highway system. We've built, you know, refineries. We've given massive subsidies to oil companies. We destroyed public transit at the behest of oil companies. We've done all this to give the oil companies and the car manufacturers the kind of power that they enjoy. You know, it seems to me that government procurement could help us, you know, nudge in the other direction.
And I agree with that, right? And what we're also seeing, and again, I think, you know, voters are generally there, right? And then so, you know, we see that there's a pretty high level of support for the government getting involved in funding more infrastructure, right? So charging stations and making it so that, you know, people can use the cars in a way that they feel comfortable with. They can, you know, they don't have to wait a couple hours in line to charge up a car and things like that. So, you know, I think there are certainly ways that, you know, that the government can help move this along and move this along quicker. And we saw a lot of that in, you know, in the bill that Biden signed last year, where, you know, massive amounts of funding going into charging stations and getting that infrastructure set up. So, you know, from what we're seeing in the numbers, you know, it's saying like that's where the focus should be more than just going out for all out. Banning of the sale of cars, because again, it's just making it too much of a political hot potato that's just going to get into unnecessary fights.
No, I can see what I see what you're saying. I mean, once we get into the red hat, blue hat stuff, progress gets shut down. You know, and I've been saying for a very long time, we need to put the red hats and the blue hats away, get a hard hat, and let's rebuild this country in a way that is going to leave our children something worth inheriting. And I think, you know, the way forward is, you know, public transit, electric alternative vehicles, you know, things like that. But I'm also a guy who loves my Jeep. I love my gas powered vehicles. I love my motorcycle. I love that stuff. I don't want to lose it. And I think that's where a lot of people have some fear. Do you agree?
Yeah, no, I think so. Right. I mean, like, look, change is difficult. Right. And if people feel like they're making the change, regardless of what it is, there's a much higher comfort level, right? So if people come to the idea of like, look, I'm going to buy the electric vehicle, that people feel are okay with that. If it's the government telling you to do something, you know, whether it's ultimately for good or not, you have a fairly large subset of the population that just doesn't like being told what to do, even if that's where they're going to end up anyway.
Right.
And, you know, looking at into some of the numbers, I mean, it's like politics hasn't quite taken over this issue yet. So we asked about funding for charging stations, right? And Republicans, this one kind of surprised me, the largest group of Republicans feel that the federal government should be putting money into charging stations, followed by the funding feeling that private business should. They're not really on board with the state government putting much money into it. And actually, there's a higher percentage of Republicans, I mean, it's only by 1 point, than independents who feel that the government should be paying, you know, the most into funding these charging stations. So, you know, which is not sort of part of the normal talking point that you get out of the Republican Party.
No, you know, the reality is that there's a lot of money in this system. The oil companies are making enormous amounts of money, you know, off of, you know, all kinds of, you know, mineral depletions and all kinds of stuff. There could be a system where they transition over, you know, and get away from, you know, the dirty stuff and towards electric. And now, look, I've got problems with how we create electricity, and I'm hoping the technology gets better down the road. And look, I agree. You know, right now, you know, I've had conversations around, you know, EVs right now, because look, the average working family, they can't afford a new car, let alone an electric vehicle. They're trying to figure out how to keep their jalopy on the road. So I kind of get where this poll is coming from. So, you know, in looking at these numbers, and again, I don't like being told what to do either, but I do want to leave something for my kids that's worth inheriting. So what do we glean from this? What do we get from this poll on how do we get to a place where we address climate and still address the needs and wants and hopes of the working class?
Right. And, I sort of made this point earlier, where I think the big thing is, like, I mean, this is one of those, if you're looking at this with, you know, sort of your progressive hat on, you know, which I am, it's like, look, the goal is to get us to, you know, as close to 100% electric vehicle as quickly as possible, right? And, you know, if we already have every major manufacturer saying that by, you know, 2032, 2035, each company is a little different, but like that they're going to be fully electric. If we see, you know, this level of support for just like, we're fine with the market moving in that direction, right? It's like, look, we're heading towards the goal we want. And yes, you know, sooner it would always be better, but if trying to make it sooner derails where we're going, it's not worth trying to get, you know, two quicker years out of it if we can get to where we want to be, you know, in those mid-2030s. So, you know, overall, you know, from the progressive standpoint, I'm like, look, this is a win, right? Like, people are there. And, you know, it's just really the sort of the hardcore conservatives are just like, bah, you know, like,
well, you're never going to get
real.
Them.
We don't need to do anything. Yeah, you're never going to get 100%.
No, you're never getting them. The fives, there. the red hats, the ones who are marching, you're not getting the most of them. And you know, for me, the idea of, you know, again, I come back to leaving something for our children that's worth inheriting. I know my environmental listeners, their heads are exploding going, what, another 2 years before we get any action? You know, cause we're told, and I don't, again, I'm not a scientist, but we're told, you know, time is short cause we've taken so long to get to this point.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think, you know, the other thing is I think the reality is also that, you know, we can't just flip the switch and tomorrow everyone has an electric vehicle, right? Like, just the infrastructure isn't there. The materials aren't there for the batteries. And you know, so yes, every year counts, but knowing how, especially Washington, you know, works these days, right? To your point, if it's red hat versus blue hat, this just gets delayed even further and progress slows down. So in the Pennsylvania survey, we had close to 60% of residents across the state saying that they felt they were probably likely to buy an electric vehicle sometime in the next decade. You know, some sooner than others. And you know, you made the point, right? I mean, when we asked people like why they didn't think they were going to buy an electric car sooner, you know, the biggest reason that people from lower income households gave was that they're too expensive. So, you know, costs are coming down. Let all this stuff needs to happen for this really to be a robust system. But people are on board. So let's do those little things that just get it moving and making sure that we stay on this path versus trying to go bigger and derailing the progress we're making.
No, I'm with you, but I'm still in this spot where if it's not government procurement, if we're not investing in it, the private sector, the market isn't going to get there until there's that push forward. And I get what you're saying. I understand it, but I'm struggling with it.
Gotcha. Well, you know, if you got the magic wand and can make things happen, right?
Yeah.
Like get the money to go into the infrastructure, get those charging stations up and running, you know, get a lot more of them. I think where the federal government can definitively be the catalyst is what they do best, right? Is they're going to invest in research, right? So let's figure out that next generation of battery that uses materials that are less harmful, right? And certainly are easier to get out of the earth, or maybe even something that doesn't come out of the earth, right?
Yeah.
Let's come up with ways that we can get these cars up to, you know, 600, 700 miles on a charge. Let's get those batteries charging within, you know, 20 minutes. All things that, from what I can see, or what people feel they, you know, believe is possible is, you know, is there. So, you know, that's, if, you know, if I had my choice, like, that's where I'm telling the government to put their money. And I think a lot of that we did see, you know, in the deal that Manchin and lots of people came to that deal, but Manchin was the big one who made that happen in the Senate.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I'm at a point where, you know, look, we definitely need to be moving in that direction, and the sooner the better that we find alternatives and we make this better off. But I'm still in this mindset that, you know, we need, you know, something of a Manhattan Project kind of all hands on deck to move in this direction. But, you know, so last question I've got for you on this. So you know, if you're talking to the elected leaders in Pennsylvania across the state, then what do they focus on if you know, saving the planet and, you know, the environment and EVs and progress, what's the message then?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something around the fact of like, look, we hear what the car companies are saying. We are glad they're heading in the direction of fully electric fleets in the next 10 years, give or take, right? The state of Pennsylvania is supportive of that, and we are going to start investing in the infrastructure needed. We're going to start putting more funding into some, you know, like, let's put funding into Carnegie Mellon, into Pitt, into Penn State, you know, Temple, whoever has the labs, the knowledge base to start, like, come up with the next battery, come up with solving some of these solutions, and, you know, let's make this happen, and let's make Pennsylvania the leader and show how this can be done.
No, I'm right there with you. So let me pull this back again, because the polling says we don't want to be moving in that direction. At least this is what I'm understanding. So you're saying we should be investing more in the technology and all this stuff, and doing that. And that's government investment. It's enormous amounts of money. How does that square with the poll?
I think that, I mean, this is what the polling is saying, right? What the polling is saying is the people are not on board with the government coming in and saying no more gas vehicles can be sold on this date. They don't like the overarching mandate of, you know, like, we are not, you know, we're not going to allow you to sell this thing. But they are fully on board with the movement to that, okay, that same point. They just want it to be more of a market solution, so to speak, versus the government saying this has to happen, even though it seems likely that it's going to end up in about the same point. So it's really more about the approach and the words and how you're getting there. But most people are on the side of let's get to that point, and you know, and we're behind that.
All right. Well, where do we find more information on this poll and the work that you guys are doing?
Our website is lpstrategies.com, and we have a bunch of the research up there. And if you if you Google around our name and Centrist Democrats, you'll see a lot of releases of the various states and different information around the survey.
All right, good stuff, Stefan. I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing some information. Glad you were here. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Stefan Hankin, founder and president of Lincoln Park Strategies, lpstrategies.com, the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1892. Striking silver miners in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, blew up the Frisco Mill. The miners were upset because the company had hired Pinkerton guards to infiltrate the mine. Working conditions in the northern Idaho mining district were terrible at that time. Many workers were injured, and some died because of lack of mine safety. When mine owners wanted to purchase new equipment, they cut costs by increasing working hours and decreasing miners' pay. In response, the miners decided to strike. The mine owners, unsurprisingly, brought in scabs. Some scabs were persuaded to honor the strike. The mine owners also hired Pinkertons to infiltrate the ranks of the strikers. One Pinkerton, Charlie Shiringo, was so successful at gaining the confidence of the strikers that he became the union's recording secretary. The infiltrator had access to the union's financial records and relayed all information he uncovered to the mine owners. By early July, union miners suspected Shiringo was a spy. The miners became more militant, and in the very early hours, miners gathered to stop a trainload of scabs from entering the mine. Pinkerton guards were brought in to protect the incoming scabs. A shootout between the guards and the miners erupted. It was unclear who shot first, but the miners retaliated by dropping a box of powder down a flume in the Frisco Mill. The box exploded, and one company employee was killed. A battle broke out at a nearby mine, and three miners were killed before owners surrendered.
Three mines fell into the hands of the workers by that evening. The governor of Idaho declared martial law and sent in the Idaho National Guard to break the union. These events helped to lead to the creation of the Western Federation of Miners.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So now look, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, the conversation I just had with Stephen Hankins. And, you know, look, I want to get us to a place where, you know, we have the ability to save the planet. You know, leave my children and grandchildren something worth inheriting. Look, the, you know, we've seen the changes that are going on. Going to happen. Now again, you know, I'm told you know, it's not man-made. I'm told, you know, by some, not the majority, that, you know, none of this is going to work. It's all, you know, just, it's all ridiculous. Now, you know, we got to burn fossil fuels. And look, I don't think we're going to ever end the use of burning fossil fuels. I don't think that's ever going to happen. But by moving in a direction that says, you know, we're going to build the infrastructure that is going to make it easier for people to buy EVs and bring the costs down by, you know, obviously producing millions of them, economies of scale. That makes sense to me. My problem is, and this is where, as a working person, I don't think we're doing what needs to be done to lay the groundwork to get us to the place where we want it. And we haven't done it for decades. None of this is new. We haven't done the work in decades. And so I get what they're trying to say. You know, we can't speed this along. My mind goes into this place. We have been so negligent. Our politicians have been, you know, political malpractice to not deal with a central issue of the future of this country and of this planet. That I think we have to be realistic that there is so much. For instance, you know, I keep hearing, well, you know, we don't create enough electricity. I think we do. I think we squander it. Oh, what do you mean, Rick? What do you mean we squander? You know, are you one of those conservation guys? Yeah, somewhat, but not a lot. Ask my wife. I leave the lights on. Jerry Brown in 1992 ran for president under the idea that we're going to rewire the entire country. You know, we lose an enormous amount of electricity in transmission. I mean, the numbers, I've seen like 70% of what we produce is lost in transmission. We could, again, put people to work, good union jobs, restringing the entire country. You know, we're still on a 50s, 1950s, 1960s kind of grid. Maybe 70s. We could be upgrading, and we should have been upgrading. We should have been doing this stuff for decades. And now we're at this point to where the consequences are becoming real. Florida may be underwater in my lifetime. Or at least the bottom part of it. So for me, the idea of let the market decide is frustrating. Because I know that the market's always manipulated. You know, I think about how we got caught on gasoline motors, how we got caught on cars. We built a massive interstate system. You know, we could have built a massive rail system. We could have had public transit all across this country. But we made a policy choice to not. And the policy choice was purely military. You know, Eisenhower saw the Autobahn and said, hey, look how they can move missiles and stuff around. We need that. And the car companies, hey, we can crush that public transit that was successful in a lot of cities. Get people into cars. Do the advertising that freedom is your car. And we bought it hook, line, and sinker because we always do. We buy the Madison Avenue stuff. Look, I love my car as much as anybody else. I've driven millions of miles. I love driving. And also, I don't like being told what to do either. But there's a moment where you go, you know what? There's a direction we should be going as a country. Getting off of the dirty fossil fuels from countries that hate us. And I know the people, oh, we should be drilling here at home. Yeah, we're drilling. Not as much as some would like. There are leases out there that, you know, oil companies have been sitting on for decades. The oil companies don't want to drill. They don't want to increase supply. They're very happy gouging you at the pump. And my fear is, and this is where my problem with the electric vehicle comes in, my fear is we get gouged by the electric companies in the future because, again, we don't have visionary politicians who are moving us in a direction that is going to ensure that the working class of this country doesn't take it on the chin again.